G'day, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction episode, the 323rd payday for the bombs. My name's Dick Newman, and before we get on with it, there was a serious whoopsie in the Canadian Parliament. Bloody dicky birds already. I mention this because a lot of my friends missed it, so let's listen in to the speaker.
We have here in the chamber today Ukrainian-Canadian world veteran from the Second World War, who fought the Ukrainian independence against the Russians and continues to support the troops today, even at his age of 98.
Yeah, the speaker seems to have forgotten there that if you're talking about the Second World War, then the Russians were the good guys. Don't get me wrong, they became the bad guys about 2 seconds after the Americans dropped the second bomb on Nagasaki, but during World War II, yeah, definitely the good guys. The guy that got 2 standing ovations in the Canadian Parliament was a former Waffen SS officer. Definitely the bad guys. So I guess we should see what Justin Trudeau eventually had to say about the thing.
Obviously, it's extremely upsetting that this happened. The speaker has acknowledged his mistake. And has apologized, but this is something that is deeply embarrassing to the Parliament of Canada and, by extension, to all Canadians.
Yeah, Justin will go on to explain to you that it's all Putin's fault, just in case you weren't aware of that. The Speaker resigned, and the Polish government have written to the Canadian government saying, can you please send that Nazi over for a little chat with us, please? Okay, let's get on with it. Yes, around about the time that our kitty George is becoming George III, we've got a child genius writing music. That was Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart with his Andante in C major, which he wrote when he was either 4 or 5. Doesn't matter, 4 or 5, one of the two, and he knocked out that little piece there as a sign of things to come. But we are still in India, where Calcutta had fallen to the Nawab of Bengal, and guys may or may not have been whacked into a slammer called the Black Hole of Calcutta. We're just not sure about that story. Now, our main players in this, so I'm sure you remember, we've got Robert Clive, our English hero, young thug who's kind of made good, I guess. The Indian guys, well, we've got the good guy, Shah Alam, our handsome, brave and strong prince. He right now wants to turn himself into the Nawab of Bengal as a stepping stone to becoming the Mughal emperor. Then he wants to make Mughal great again. So right now his dad is the Mughal emperor, but a puppet under our prince's main enemy, the psycho teenage Disney villain evil vizier guy. The current Nawab of Bengal is Siraj ud-Daulah. And he's a young guy also, and a nasty bit of work. He's the guy that's done over Calcutta, but now we've got Robert Clive going for him. We had left it with Robert Clive just taking Fort Budge Budge. His guys had managed to walk through swamps and crap and whatever, and carry cannon with them. And the local Raj defending the fort had no idea that they were capable of doing that, so he's run away with a bullet hole in his turban. Off we go further up the river, and 2 more forts will just be abandoned. They've heard by now that the British are very, very scary. Besides, who wants to fight and die for that dead shit Siraj ud-Daulah? 2nd of January 1757, and our ships can see Fort William. It's being defended by that Raj Minak Chan, who will wait for a brief exchange of fire before running away again. Yeah, he's a runaway type, isn't he? Clive can just march on in and raise his standard. The refugees can go back to their homes. The place has been smashed up, but it is back in the hands of the company. 3rd of January, and it'll be a war, huh? What is it good for? Admiral Watson has declared war on Siraj ud-Dowlah in the name of the Crown. So far, so boring. But Robert Clive has also declared war on Siraj ud-Dowlah in the name of the company. This is a new game, a corporation declaring war. You might recall, though, in their charter, the company were given all sorts of power. They were the powers of a government, and that includes the ability to declare war. Clive will not be buggering around. While the engineers are starting to rebuild the fortifications of Fort William and finally demolishing those buildings overlooking the walls, Clive is off to attack Bengal's principal port. He wants revenge for the destruction of Calcutta, and he has the men and weapons to do it. It won't take the lads long to have the siege ladders out, and they're all into the fort with bugger all losses. The garrison in the fort can be slaughtered. The port can be looted and burned. Looting parties will fan out to start looting further and then burning the houses. They will keep on going, destroying villages, and everybody will be back by nightfall. 4th of February, and Siraj ud-Dowlah is back camping in a pleasure garden on the northern outskirts of Calcutta. The company will send two negotiators who will get nothing except an invite to come back tomorrow, but they suspect it's going to be a trap. Clive will fall back on his greatest hit, the surprise motherfucker night attack. 5th of February, and we've got a nice winter fog, so we can have some silent marching. 470 regulars, 800 sepoys, 6 field artillery, 1 howitzer, and as many sailors as could be spared. Some gunners and some riflemen among them. Our guys will march pretty much through the entire enemy camp to the middle and then open fire. But after some initial confusion, the enemy will start to surround the British, and oh, it's getting rather hot in there. Clive will have to get his guys out. He's lost somewhere around 150 guys, and 2 cannon got stuck in the mud. His idea of killing or capturing the Nawab has failed. They couldn't really see because of the fog. They had no idea that actually scared the crap out of Siraj ud-Dowlah, who ran away quick smart. Nor did they know that for their 150 guys, they did over around about 1,500 infantry, 600 cavalry, and even 4 poor old elephants died. From the point of view of the Bengalis, this was extremely scary, and they considered themselves lucky that the fog was about. Clive will find that out the next day when an ambassador comes in with peace proposals. Siraj, the dickhead, has finally worked out that smashing the shit out of Calcutta was actually an own goal. His economy has taken a big hit. Remember Baby Ted, my dear listener. Always make war on your enemy's turf, not your own. Siraj has signed off on a treaty that gives the British pretty much everything they want, and now trade will be free of taxes. And those fortifications, well, sure, build away. You want a mint? Great. Have a mint. Mint your own coins. Only one teeny tiny condition. Only one. This is the only condition I want, Pogs. I want Roger Drake sacked as governor. Oh, shit, that'll be a no worries on the sacking of Drake. They were going to sack him anyway. With that, Siraj ud-Dowlah is on the march back to Mushirabad, leaving Clive and Watson totally astonished. Yeah, what's going on? Clive can head back to Madras, having achieved everything he set out to do at a minimal cost and casualties. For Admiral Watson, it's a bit more complicated. He's just been notified that the 7-year war has started. It's obviously not called the 7-year war just yet. The war is to happen wherever in the world there are both Frenchies and British. For Watson, the Frenchies are 20 miles upstream at Chandanagar. The Frenchies at Chandanagar have been our friends. Look, right now they've got some of our refugees from Calcutta. They're looking after the people. The Frenchy governor just dislikes Roger Drake, but everybody dislikes Roger Drake. The Frenchy governor had also got news that we're at war, so he sent a nice note up to Calcutta saying, hey guys, why don't we just ignore each other and keep on making money? Sure, say the Calcutta guys, we'll sign a local treaty just you and us. But Admiral Watson has other ideas. The final 2 ships of his fleet have finally found their way in after B being scattered in the monsoons, so the Admiral has more resources. Off goes Clive with a small army, 2,700 men. The Nawab had ticked off on this action in return for the company promising to help the Nawab in the event of an Afghan invasion. The Afghans have just taken Delhi. Yeah, every man and his dog's going to take Delhi. Back to Clive, who will demand the Frenchies surrender. Sorry, no, say the Frenchies. The Frenchies have this reputation, I don't know, my dear listener, they have this reputation for not being brave. Total crap. The 700 Frenchie defenders will fight very bravely in their burning and disintegrating buildings. Yeah, they're being blown to bits, but they'll keep fighting. They know there's no relief force coming to help out. They know that. There's none around. They know they're on their own. The British mainly wanted to assault by ship, but the Frenchies had smartly installed chains and scuttled some of their own ships to create obstacles. Here's Clive's nephew writing. The difficulty was at last removed, once the chains and booms had been cut away, and the two ships drew near the fort. But before they got within musket shot, the French from 16 guns made great havoc. When the broadsides began to fire, the enemy soon quitted their guns, for they lost 150 officers in 2 hours, and the faces of two bastions were in the meantime brought to the ground, so that the messieurs hung out a flag and surrendered at discretion. Before they did so, a quarter deck of the Kent was cleared of every man but the Admiral Watson and a pilot, Captain Speke, and all the officers being killed or wounded, as were about 150 men in both ships. The Tiger suffered vastly in seamen and the Kent both in officers and sailors. Captain Speke has his leg sadly mauled, and his son Billy has lost one of his with part of his thigh by the same shot. The charming young fellow Perot was shot through the head, and Second Lieutenant Hayes lost his thigh and is since dead. And we, the land forces, were under the cover of houses. We suffered little, though we greatly incommoded the enemy in reverse by our shot and shell. It must be owned, considering all things, that the messieurs made a good defence, though the fort held out only 2 hours after the ships came before it. This, then, was a very bloody battle, even if in scale it's not large. It's over a bit of real estate in India, which seems crazy, but what it's really about is the British wanting a monopoly on trade in Bengal. And of course they do now. So look, it was all about money. That's what it was about. Or in the words of a Frenchie who was there, it opened a gate onto the road of glory and riches. Yes, he says that, but at least he can see the other side. A flourishing colony was destroyed, and many honest people in French India were ruined. Indeed, I saw myself ruined. Now, Siraj ud Dowlah was indecisive about the whole thing. Clearly, he had wanted to help out the Frenchies to keep the balance of power, and even sent a relief force, only to call it back. Next day, he will send the Poms a "well done on winning the battle" card with a nice present, two leopards. What has our Indian chronicler got for us? Now, taking the cotton wool of recklessness from the ear, the young Nawab tried to win the friendship of Clive with a gift of two leopards, extremely good at catching deer. But now it was much too late, for the arrow of fate cannot be parried by the shield of effort once God's decree has already passed another way. Siraj has managed to piss pretty much everybody off. He certainly pissed off the merchants with his destruction, which has stuffed up trade. Worse, these are the Seths, who Siraj kept threatening with circumcision, but they don't want to be Muslims. The top Seth, of course, is Jagat Seth, the top banker. This is probably the richest Indian family so far, and certainly the richest Indian family of the time. They're bad people to piss off. Siraj, you might recall, had also pissed off the top military guys. That's always a shit idea. Top of the pissed off military types was Mir Jafar Ali Khan, who comes from Najaf. That would be modern Iraq. Mir Jafar was the guy who kept beating off the Marathas for the Nawabs. Then he successfully took Calcutta from the British for Siraj, who promptly gave the governorship of Calcutta to Mir Jafar's main rival. Merger Farr was obviously good at organisation, so it'll be he who sends messages round to guys like Jagat Seth saying, "Hey, you are not alone in wanting to get rid of Suraj permanently." The plotters thought they might support Suraj's cousin, but he was psychotic and permanently stoned on opium. He went into battle stoned and probably never even felt the musket ball that went straight through his head. But now our plotters can spot Clive, who was rather handy. Word will get out and Clive's in. Yeah, he's happy to get rid of Suraj. He actually really wanted to get back to Madras to guard against a Frenchy attack, but it's tricky leaving a loose cannon like Suraj running around. Clive will write to the government of Madras saying what a shithead Suraj is. "This induces me to acquaint you that there is a conspiracy carrying on against him by several of the great men, at the head of whom is Jagat Seth himself. I have been applied to for assistance and every advantage promised that the company can wish. The committee are of the opinion that it should be given as soon as the Nabob is secured." Yeah, they can't say Nabob, they've got to say Nabob. "For my part, I am persuaded that there can be neither peace nor security while such a monster reigns. Merger Farr has managed to unite the merchants and bankers with his army, who now look to bring in the mercenary troops of the East India Company. And what I have to say is this is not some colonial master plan. It's just circumstances. Clive is overstepping his orders, which are just to repulse any Frenchy attacks and avoid wars with the locals. But Clive can see there is a shit ton of money to be made, so it's all been nicely dressed up for the board in London. And hey, I shall say it out loud, the big prize would be Frenchy's totally out and a monopoly for us. Now it's just a matter of squeezing some testicles to get a really, really, really good deal for our conducting a nice bit of regime change. And won't we be finding out just how profitable regime change can be? Merger Farr, the military man, and the Jagat Seths will be upping their offer significantly. The entire equivalent of 1 year's revenue for Bengal. That would be £3 million. And wait, there's more. 110,000 rupees a month to pay the troops' wages. In addition, the company will score land, a mint, and duty-free trade. Merger Farr will pay a further £1 million in compensation for the loss of Calcutta and £500,000 to be distributed to the European inhabitants to rebuild their houses. My dearest listener, I do not think we have had a deal coming anywhere near this in our history so far. Nothing like it. It is huge. But I did tell you that India, including its GDP compared to Britain, was huge. So, yeah, they can offer a huge deal and they just have. We just have to get our man snuck in to sign off on the deal. Now let's see, what do our kings and princes do? Well, they get done up in drag, don't they? Well, the Indians have got something way better than that. It is a covered harem palanquin. There you go. Nobody is going to look into one of those, so off goes our man to Mir Jafar to get his signature and take their formal oath on the Quran. The company select committee will countersign it. 13th of June 1757, 1 year to the day since the attack on Calcutta, and Clive will send an ultimatum to Suraj. "You broke the treaty, so you are an arsehole. We hate you." Off he goes with 800 Europeans, 2,200 Indian sepoys, and just 8 cannon, heading towards Plassey and a date with destiny. gentle as anything, also have a date with destiny, it seems. It'll be a nice walk through rice paddies, lovely and green, lots of water and vegetation. Got bullocks are in there ploughing the rich mud of the rice fields, while friendly villagers herd goats and ducks. There's thatched cottages with green bamboo growing and groves of giant banyans where the parakeets fly round. The water is sadly too shallow for the admiral to bring his battleships, but there's plenty of small wooden bamboo boats to transport officers and supplies and lots of ammo. Clive, though, is anxious. He's had lots of communication from the plotters, but now suddenly it's all gone silent. He's not getting a cracker. He then will open up communication with the bankers, the Jagged Seths. Just a g'day, I'm in Colner, and the lads have laid off the loot and plunder. No reply. Next day, he'll write to the army, the Jaffier. This time, he's up the ante. G'day, mate, I'm at Tantasol, and expect your news, and will do whatever you desire. Let me hear from you twice a day, and I won't budge until I hear from you. Again, no reply. Dear me, Clive is suspicious. Is this some sort of weird counterplot to do over the British? He will again write to Mir Jafar. Very surprised at not hearing from you and expect you will let me know your intentions. More silence. And despite this, he will send a platoon forward to take the fort of Katwa. That's done easy peasy, but that's where Mir Jafar was supposed to join Clive, but there's no sign of him. Clive will write to the site committee in Calcutta seeking directions on how to proceed. But finally in comes a late night letter from Mir Jafar. It says, the Nabob has insisted that Mir Jafar be on Team Nabob. Yeah, well, Mir Jafar could hardly have said no, so said yes, but still intends to stay on Team Conspirators. Clive will write back saying great, and give me your advice on how to proceed. But then, having slipped on it, Clive is back to being worried. It gives me great concern that in an affair of so much consequence, to yourself in particular, that you do not exert yourself more. Then it's basically, look, your letter gave me no real information about what's going on. Surely you should have been writing to me daily to keep me briefed. Just bring what guys you can and join me. Clive will call a council of war. The Nawab is just one day's march away and he has 50,000 guys to our 3,000. He's got 53 bits of artillery to our 8. Council of war mob say, oh, this is a no-brainer. We need to run away. Now, Clive can see the sense in that advice, but on waking will change his mind and say, fuck it, we're going in. Letter from Mir Jafar saying, when you come near, I shall be able to join you. That's not what Clive asked for. He wanted Mir Jafar to come over now and join now. Bring some hard men now. Clive will write back, I shall be on the other side of the river this evening. If you will join me at Plassey, I will march halfway to meet you. Then the whole Nabob's army will know I fight for you. Give me leave to call to your mind how much your own glory and safety depend on it. Be assured if you do this, you will be Subah, that's the governor, of these provinces. But if you cannot go even this length to assist us, I call God to witness the fault is not mine, and I must desire your consent for concluding a peace with the Nabob. Oh, dear me, that's not sounding very good. The British will start marching at sunset and get to Plassey about 1 a.m. They arrive at a nice hunting lodge owned by the Nawab, so Clive can have a nice sleep in the lodge. Soldiers can take shelter from the heavy rain in the mango orchard. Yeah, I reckon that would be a mosquito paradise. 7 a.m, no further word from Mir Jafar, so Clive will write saying, hey, I'm going to kiss and make up with Siraj ad-Dowlah if you stay silent. I shall march, and if you don't join me, then that's it. You will find me being Siraj's bestie. But it's all a bit pointless because the Nawab's army is already on the move and Clive is encircled. Clive will be up on the roof to have a good gander at the enemy and it'll be, fuck me, we're all a bit fucked here. No, he didn't write that at all. What with the number of elephants all covered in scarlet embroidery, their horses with drawn swords glittered in the sun, their heavy cannon drawn by vast trains of oxen, and their standards flying, they made a pompous and fabulous sight. What he saw is what I said. 35,000 infantry, 15,000 cavalry, 53 pieces of heavy artillery, which were superintended by a team of French experts. Mayor Jaffar will do, well, whatever he's going to do, but for the British, there's only one option right now, and that's fight. The Nawab is going cannon, and there are about 30 sepoys off to Valhalla, or wherever the fuck sepoys go. Reincarnation, I guess, is the most likely. Clive will withdraw his guys to shelter under a muddy riverbank with plenty of cannon and musket shot flying overhead. Oh, overhead's fine. Who cares? There's no chance of sneaking out and taking the enemy artillery, so the plan is sit tight all day, make a move at night. But around midday, we will get a monsoon-type storm. Our British training will kick in, and our guys will take all necessary precautions to keep their powder dry. The Nawab's mob do not. The cannon fall silent. Clive is off to the hunting lodge, and once it stops raining, he will be out in a nice dry uniform. The Nawab's cavalry commander has assumed that, like the Nawab's cannon, the company's cannon are also out of action. He will get 5,000 of his elite Afghan horsey types and charge. Ghulam Hussein Khan wrote, "But as the nation of hat wearers have no equals in the art of firing their artillery and musketry with both order and rapidity, there commenced such an incessant rain of balls and bullets and such hot endless firing that the spectators themselves were amazed and confounded, and those in the battle had their hearing deafened by the continual thunder and their eyesight dimmed by the endless flashing of the execution." The Nawab's cavalry commander copped a cannonball to his tummy. Oh, ouch, that's got to hurt. Plenty of guys saw that and just started to move away. More and more move away, and before you know it, the Nawab's huge army is on the run. Clive's deputy, Major Kilpatrick, will notice that nobody's at the Nawab's cannon, so without permission and in defiance of orders to stay put, he will advance and take some of the guns. Clive will send angry messages, but that is what will win this battle. That's because, having done a bit of running away, the Nawab's troops have had time to think that they've got the British outnumbered about 20-1 and almost completely surrounded, so they've started wandering back. But what do they see now? The British in charge of their guns. Clive has twigged and sent gunners and troops to take charge of more cannon. Here comes a huge cavalry force, but finally it's Mir Jaffar, who will withdraw just as he promised. Now the Nawab's infantry will see the company in charge of their guns and a big mob of their cavalry going away, so this time they will totally panic and start running. The battle is won. Siraj ud-Dula escaped on a camel to Mashhadabad. Early next morning he was off with whatever loot he could carry. Clive will write a rather sarcastic note to Mir Jaffar. "I congratulate you on the victory, which is yours, not mine." Yeah, right. Mir Jaffar will turn up at the British camp, and it seems pretty obvious that, like Clive, he was worried about treachery. He was very nervous, but here is Clive to give him a big cuddle and declare he is governor of Bengal. Clive had no treachery on his mind, just a nice puppet governor, and he's got one. Clive is over his annoyance with the whole lack of communication stuff because we won. Yeah, who cares now? His advice to Mir Jaffar is to get back to Mashhadabad ASAP to secure the capital and the treasury. It will take Clive and the troops 3 days to march back, but he can't go straight in because the Jagat Seths tell him there's an assassination plot on the go. But a couple of days later, Clive will make his triumphant entry. Clive will pop Mir Jaffar onto the big chair and salute him as governor, or Nawab, whatever you want to call him. I don't care what you call him. Clive will say that the company would not be interfering with the government, and we are just here for a bit of commerce. As we turn to the cupboard, it is, of course, a bit bare. Mir Jaffar and Clive will need to chat to the bankers for a loan to pay the huge amounts promised for this regime change. Guy was personally to receive a £234,000 and a bit of property worth £27,000 a year. At 33, he was about to become one of the 1% richest people in Europe, but only if Bengal can pay him. Clive and Mir Jafar are back to not trusting each other while the Jagat Seths check the cushions of the sofa for spare change. There are letters back and forth, and what Clive wants is for Jagat Seth to show me the money. While that was going on, Mir Jafar's son was on the hunt for Siraj Ud Dawla, who oddly enough finds he doesn't have many friends at all. 2 days out of the palace and one Shah Dana will spot Siraj. Shah Dana was a Sufi Muslim who had been oppressed by Siraj, so we'll be delighted to send word of the location of Siraj to those on the hunt for him. Shah Dana will also be most pleased to go to the authorities to suggest they nab Siraj, which they do. He can be dragged back to Mashuradabad as a very sad ex-Nawab. He will be hacked to pieces, 25, and dead. Terribly sorry to have to tell you this, but the custom was that all his women must also die. There were about 70 women in his house or harem or whatever, who all died except for one. Luft-un-Nissa was considered to be the hottest chick on the planet, so she'll be popped into a slammer rather than murdered. Both Mir Jafar and his son will propose marriage to her over time. She will have a reply. Having ridden on an elephant before, I cannot agree to ride on a donkey. Yeah, well, apparently Siraj was terribly good-looking and a total bad boy, so yeah, one of those chicks-dig-the-bad-boy things going on there, I'd say. She will eventually be let out of the slammer, and her daughter will marry Siraj's nephew, who will end up becoming the Nawab in the future. Dead Siraj will be paraded through the town and Clive and company will get their money. It'll take 200 boats to carry all that cash up to Calcutta. It's just the start. Lots of cash will be provided by the Nawabs of Bengal to the company as political gifts, much like our modern-day corporations provide gifts to politicians without any expectation whatsoever of political favours back. No, none at all, no expectation of favours back for political donations. Clive is writing that he's brought about a revolution and he is not wrong, or not far wrong. He's a bit up himself. Commercial corporation has obtained real political power. Life is about to change bigly in India. The Marathas might have been brutal with the kill, 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 loot, plunder, burn, and all that stuff. The company will politely start removing the wealth of India to Britain and it won't be coming back. No, not at all. The British have become the dominant military and political force in Bengal. They have got the idea that if they grow their army, then they can just keep taking control of different bits of the country, either directly or, like our dear old Romans, through a puppet. Much easier that way. Just get yourself a puppet. With all that upset around the place, there are plenty of guys with the right name or the right DNA who were dispossessed and dissatisfied, who are making alliances here and there, but not bringing about peace and stability. In fact, peace and stability will last 3 months only in March in Dabad, and Clive will be back to see if he can sort out what's turned into a bit of chaos. Mir Jafar has been busy trying to purge the members of the Siraj regime, who had caused some violence. Mir Jafar's not up to the job, and he hasn't got a lot of support. He's sitting on a throne that is warm with the blood of his former boss, and people kind of don't like that. This will see the start of a drift of people moving away from the Nawabs and over to the company. Merchants, bankers and civil servants all see the company as a more favourable organisation to work either for or with. Clive and the company had only intended to get a more friendly Nawab, but what they've done is undermine the authority of the Nawabs, and in Bengal that's bringing chaos. A year later, to celebrate Plassey, Mir Jafar will visit Calcutta for a state visit. It will be magnificent, with lots of, oh, I love you, man, no, I love you, man, all that shit going on. But the two governments are only putting on a show. Underneath, there is a mutual dislike. Clive writes of Mir Jafar as the old fool and his son as the worthless young dog. It seems that getting the top job and finding a big fat jar of opium have changed Mir Jafar. Yes, but we should also say, look, Clive, you have a squint in the mirror, mate. Clive is puffed up and feels super important. He's wondering why he's even sharing power with his muggle nawabs. He is writing to London to let them know that his sepoys are now highly trained and disciplined. He could perhaps seize Bengal and run it. What do you think, directors? There is a telling part of his correspondence. Here's what he says. They have adopted a system of politics more peculiar to this country than any other, viz., to attempt everything through treachery rather than force. Under these circumstances, may not so weak a prince as Mir Jafar be easily destroyed or influenced by others to destroy us? What then can enable us to secure our present acquisitions or improve upon them, but such force as leaves nothing to the power of treachery or ingratitude? So yeah, there's no meeting of minds on the political scene. Mir Jafar seems to have no real idea of what the company is. He seems to think it's some person, first name V, second name Company. Yeah, Mr. V Company. And he says how much he looks forward to meeting the company. And here's some nice presents for you, Mr. The Company. The other part of that letter shows that Clive is tweaked. There's no loyalty among the soldiers. They work for whoever pays them, so technically, sure, Mir Jafar could hire a ton of soldiers to come and do over the company in Bengal. Technically only. Surely our company directors don't get what's going on. No, they're not really up to speed either. Nobody quite understands this stuff. They are still trying to work out who this Siraj ud-Dowla is. And he's been overthrown and murdered? What? In fact, one director has so little clue who Siraj ud-Dowla is, he's talking about some bloke, Sir Roger Dulat. Yeah, no, it's not Sir Roger, mate. It's Siraj ud-Dowla. What they certainly do understand, the company that is, what they certainly understand is just how much cash Clive is bringing with him. Clive is also bringing a new word for us from the Hindi. Our new word is loot, to plunder, as in carry-off loot. Loot is what we have just started doing to India. Yes, so India, if you could just bend over and drop your pants, that'd be great, thanks. This is actually huge, my dear listener. Well, I've already said it's huge. Not since Hernan Cortes fucked over the then Aztec Mexicans have we seen a European come home with this much cash. February 1760, and Clive and his Mrs. Margaret will set sail for England on the Royal George. In they come. Clive will buy the estate of Walcott in Shropshire and lease a nice house in Berkeley Square, Mayfair. He will buy the Claremont estate from the Duchess of Newcastle and a weekend retreat at Esher and some surrounding land and some land in County Clare. And let's not forget a diamond necklace for Margaret's pet ferret. So, yes, a nice big fat spending spree for Clive, while the Bengal that he left behind sinks into chaos. Mir Jafar managed to scrape enough cash together to pay his army 3 months' wages. The problem was he owed them 13 months' wages. The troops are openly mutinous. Some were starving. The horses were certainly starving. Trouble had been with spending. Mir Jafar liked the sparkly jewels and spent tons of cash on them. Mir Jafar is not the right guy to be running Bengal. He is an uneducated Arab soldier with zero political skills or admin skills or much anything, really. By 1760, then, we had three separate rebellions on the go, but all about the same thing. Mir Jafar had paid Clive and the company way too much cash, and now local authorities are deprived of cash to keep the ship of state sailing. The Jagat Seths have worked out that they backed a loser, so they'll be refusing loans to put down revolts, which are spreading quickly. The Seths will say, oh, we need to go and do a holy pilgrimage to Parasnath, which is a Jainus thingy. The bankers are gone and the government is paralysed. Mir Jafar has a nasty son, Miran, who has no idea about stuff like compassion or forgiveness, so he can be off murdering people. Miran is not only hitting Siraj's family, he's going after Siraj's granddad's family. So that's the last two Nawabs to ensure that their family don't stage a counter takeover. Old granddad's harem women will all be drowned. That's nasty. Family members murdered. Siraj's teenage brother will be tortured to death just for a bit of extra special nastiness for him. More deaths to follow. Favourites of the old regime, favourites of the new regime. Oh, we're getting to our own guys now. A couple of ministers. Yeah, we're definitely getting into our own guys by now. And Moran is feeding his paranoia. The company are helping the chaos by undermining the economy. English traders have been going all over Bengal, taking over markets, and before you know it, 33 private businesses will have 400 nice new British trading posts around the place. They will tell local officials wanting tax to just go and get stuffed. We don't pay taxes, we don't pay tolls, we don't pay customs duties, and the land we're on is ours because we're on it. And no, we don't need to pay rent for it. No, and we don't need to buy it. We're British, it's ours. Now, this is not the government, my dear listener, not the British government, it's the company. And it might not even really be quite the company because it's just hard men who go out and do whatever the fuck they want. Now, so long as they pay the company something, then, yeah, do what the fuck you want, mate. Here's an example. The law of Bengal says that only the Nawab can manufacture and trade in salt. Archibald Kerr is employing 13,000 men to manufacture 12,000 tons of salt a year. You don't have to be English. Here's a Frenchie who can pay the company for whatever it was they wanted, passes, permissions, and of course he will be hiring sepoys so he can get into business. This guy is a hard man using the sepoys not only to protect his goods but to force people to purchase his goods at the price that he sets. The further away from Calcutta, the worse it gets. And here's a quote. British soldiers and traders permit themselves all sorts of liberties in the pursuit of private profit or in the hope of impunity. I have seen some so far forget their duty that they beat to death unfortunate Indians to extract money not owed to them. Yeah, not owed. The country lies under the anarchy. Laws have no power of sanction. Morals are corrupt to the ultimate degree. The people groan under a multitude of vexations, all caused by the decay and confusion into this once great empire has fallen, with legitimate rulers having neither credibility nor authority. This rich and fertile land is turning into a desert. It is lost unless some sudden general revolution restore its ancient splendour. Yes, I'm not going that well, really, for India under the British company rule. The new governor is a young guy, Warren Hastings, who has no problem being a whistleblower. He thinks what's going on is very, very wrong. Young Warren was a rising star. He had a poor background. Mum died in childbirth and his dad pissed off to Barbados, where he promptly died. So Warren was educated in one of those charity schools for poor kiddies. But here comes an uncle to get him into a decent school where he'll be a top scholar until he's 16 when his uncle dies, so he can't keep going to school. Off to Bengal, just in time to be a prisoner of Siraj ad-Daulah when the factory of Qasim Bazar fell. By then he was a buyer of silk and he'd fallen in love with India. He became fluent in Urdu and Bengali, as well as speaking a bit of Persian. There you go, one of those weirdos we hardly ever find in history, and yeah, they're pretty thin on the ground in our current times. A guy who wants to defend the rights of your average Bengali rather than just make more money. Warren Hastings then is working against the tide, trying to keep Mir Jafar's regime from collapse. That's pretty tricky, given that the British are taking over the economy and not paying a cracker to the government. The government sepoys have taken matters into their own hands. It's become violent on the streets, and hey, good luck, Warren Hastings, and let us have another example of British behaviour in this time and location. There is this Kashmiri trader, part of the dynasty of Patna-based merchant princes. This guy is dumb fat and happy on the saltpeter trade. With the support of the Nawab, the guy had a virtual monopoly on the saltpeter, leading to the English to lodge plenty of complaints over time. We do not like monopolies when other people have them, my dear listener. We're okay if we've got them. We think they're pretty good then, but not when other people have them, no. Within a couple of months of the overthrow of Siraj Ud Daulah, a company man named Paul Perks broke into the saltpeter workhouse with his hard men and just took the saltpeter. Just took it. Now, I know what you're thinking, that's outright theft, but no. Paul Perks explained that he was sure that there were illegal Frenchy goods in that warehouse, so he needs to hang on to everything in the warehouse. Yeah. This is exactly what happens these days. We decide to sanction a company, and then they might have some gold lodged in a European bank or whatever, and we say, yeah, we're pretty sure they're going to use that for terrorist activity, so we'll just be hanging on to that gold. In this case, it will take a lot of time and a personal appeal to Clive for our Kashmiri trader to get his saltpeter back. By 1760, we have the bankers, the Jagat Seths, as well as the merchants, like our Kashmiri trader, turning against the new regime and on the lookout for a new Nawab and perhaps to get rid of the company. Whoever can they get to help them out on this little endeavour? Well, you recall, we've got our handsome, intelligent Shah Alam, who had escaped the homicidal teenager evil Disney vizier in Delhi, and Shah Alam is still wandering around. He has gathered guys to him who want to support his quest to get the old Mughal Empire going again. Make Mughal great again. They have a nice range of Make Mughal Great Again turbans, I believe. 4 days after Clive had left India, Shah Alam crossed the border into Mir Jafar's dominions to retake the rich and beautiful province of Bengal as a nice start to the empire. Well, that's his claim. The place can make plenty of cash for him to enable him to defeat the psychotic teen Imad al-Mukh, our Disney vizier villain. Step one will be to attack Patna, and here comes the old Mughal nobility of Bengal to help him. If you think it's bad in Bengal, well, you're right, but it's worse in Delhi. Successive armies have just come in to do some kill, loot, rape, whatever. Somehow, psychotic teen Imad al-Mukh has managed to cling onto power during all this. He's been doing plenty of murdering, including our handsome prince's dad, the puppet emperor. Yeah, he's dead now. Shah Alam then has the title of Mughal emperor, but none of the cash, power, hard men, or anything much, really. Just charm, and of course, he can promise titles and estates to supporters, but promise only at this stage. In order to deliver, the empire needs to come back, and Psycho Teen needs to exit the planet. Yeah, he needs to go to heaven. Charm has got our prince around 20,000 followers. These are guys who are as broke as he is, though. He's got no European-type infantry, no artillery. Yeah, that's a bit tricky. In comes Jean-Laure de Lauriston, who is on the run from the company. Well, he's a Frenchie. Of course he's on the run. Jean-Laure will record what the emperor said to him. He keeps meeting with the Nawabs and Rajas, who actually don't mind that the empire has disappeared. It saves them paying taxes. Oh, God. So here he is for Bengal to do or die. Just as he recorded the emperor's words for us, Jean-Laure left his own observations. All any of the power players want, any of them, needs more money, and to fuck over the poor. Whenever I wanted that one of these famous potentates like Siraj Abdullah or Imad al-Mulk or their peers, out of honour and a regard for the regulation of the government, should undertake to put in order the affairs of Bengal and suppress the English, not one of them felt any inclination for the task. They did not once weigh in their minds the shamefulness of their conduct. The Indian nobles are a set of disorderly, inconsistent blockheads who exist solely for ruining the world of people. And there you have it, my dear listener. That's the problem in India. It's the rich. It doesn't matter where you are, common smellies get a raw deal. Britain's about to become super rich, but the common smellies won't find life improving. As for the common smelly Indians, well, that's not going to change their lives much as to which rich guys have the money. Indian or English, it's pretty much all the same. Back to Jean Law, who brought with him a force of 100 of the last Frenchy troops in India and 200 sepoys who really do actually know their business. Shah Alam can order coins minted and sermons be given in the name of the King of the World, Warrior, Emperor, Exalted Seed, with the glorious aureole of kingship of the ancient Persian kings. May God grant him eternal rule. Shah Alam can also have his portrait done. Yeah, it's very important stuff there, my dear listener, very important. And it's reviewed the army, but we may not want to look, my dear listener. Underpaid and under-equipped is just the start. Even so, they will get off to a promising start. Guys not only promise support, they come in with troops. And that will include two of Mir Jafar's senior army types who have defected. Great. Shah Alam will go the surprise motherfucker at Masanpur. Despite being well and truly outgunned, the Emperor's forces will prevail. But Shah Alam made the mistake of letting the pro-English forces run away and not riding them down for some kill, kill, kill. Dear me, nice guys can find out that sort of stuff does not pay off. If he'd chased them down, then he could have taken the city of Patna, which would have provided plenty of cash. But no, that didn't happen. The enemy army will move into Patna. Oh, they've got all the cash, and they can sit nice and safe behind the walls. And our emperor can suddenly remember that he's got no fucking cannon for a siege. You wanker. Mir Jafar will get the news, and he'll be in despair. Less than a week later, though, and Major Collard will march into Patna, relieve the garrison, then march on the Emperor's forces. The Indian guys will be pretty useless and run away from the Emperor's troops, but Collard had highly trained and disciplined sepoys who will just form a square, do the rapid firing into the Emperor's flanks, and the Emperor's troops will soon also be running away. But Shah Alam hasn't come all this way just to give up. He will get his elite, lightly equipped cavalry and ride like a wind on Murshidabad. Oh, I can never say that quite right. But, oh, I see, says your podcaster. Excellent plan. Surprise motherfucker, the capital, and go in for a quick takeover. I like this plan. I like it. How will it go? Collard does not have the intelligence in place to know what is going on. He will find out after a few days and then assemble his crack team of horsey chasers. The Emperor has a 3-day head start and will get to Burdwan, where his cavalry commander handily has an uncle who is the Raja. Oh, this is going well. But it needs to be about the surprise motherfucker and not about a 3-day rest to cancel out the 3-day head start. But it's going to be a 3-day rest. Bugger. By the time Shah Alam got back on the road, Collard had caught them up and, in conjunction with Mir Jafar's army, which has marched out, blocked the road. There is no hope of any surprising any motherfuckers. If only Shah Alam had kept going, he would have found Murshidabad undefended. But now he's blocked and Mir Jafar has further reinforcements on their way. The position is hopeless, so Shah Alam will have to retreat back to Patna. The people welcomed him the first time with plenty of cheering and waving, but now he's back with a rather large army that's hanging around and discipline's lacking. That means oppression of the people, who will soon be praying for an English victory. At least some of Shah Alam's troops are deserting. The Emperor ran, but cannot hide. The British know where he is. Elephant versus cannon, not much of a contest, really. The British by now are rather good at aiming the things, so one ball will take out the Emperor's Mahout, or elephant driver, with another shot wounding the elephant, and it will wander off taking the Emperor with it. Can it be worse? Mir Jafar had also chipped in with bribes to take Shah Alam's top commander, who will now swap sides. All the Emperor's troops can now do is run away. Jean-Laure de Lauriston will be captured. He had held out, but eventually his guys thought, well, if the Emperor's gone, then why are we hanging around? We should go too. Jean-Laure then sat on his big old cannon and waited to be killed. But the Brits will say, no way would we kill a fair dinkum brave Frenchie, mate. Now, what about real words? You have done everything that can be expected from a brave man, and your name shall undoubtedly be transmitted to posterity by the pen of history. Now, loosen your sword from your loins, come amongst us, and abandon all thoughts of contending with the English. And that's about where we need India to be for the time being, so I think we would need to return to merry old England and George III, but we'll have to do that next week. One thing that would make your podcaster very happy is a serious Three Musketeers movie, which I got during the week. The Frenchies made it. So it is in French, there is that. You have to read the subtitles unless you can understand French yourself. But it's a marvellous telling of the story. And we've got some guys in there that I particularly like. A guy called Romain Duris. I bet I said his name wrong. I love every movie he's in. And another guy you'd recognise, Vincent Cassel. You'd recognise him, I'm sure, because he gets a lot of work. We've got Eva Green as Milady, Vicky Krieps as Queen Anne. So it's a serious telling, and there's going to be a sequel, I'm sure of that, because it left you on a bit of a cliffhanger. So to give it its full name, The Three Musketeers d'Artagnan, which is highly recommended. But for us, it's a matter of what we go out with. And Screaming Jets bass guitar player Paul Wussing died. He's only 56. Shouldn't have died, but he did. So we'll go out with a bit of Screaming Jets and Stop the World. Hope to see you next week. Bye.